Cheryl? Oh, there we are. Okay, all right, here's the hard part, getting it back. So, how about those Dodgers? No, I'll get it. I just have to be careful I don't turn it off again. Okay. Wow. Let's just try that again. Good morning. Anybody notice the Hensons are home? Joanne and Dean are here today. I have another sweet, may I share? May I share your special good? Betty, can I share your special good? All right, you don't want me to, I won't. They have special good to share, though. Yesterday, right here, we had a wedding with Betty and Larry. Raise your hands, Betty and Larry. The poetess found her man. Congratulations, we're so happy that you chose to share your honeymoon with us. That's a great way to start a marriage. So I have something to say today that is, I'm so glad the Hensons are back, because this is really an important message. Now, last week, I proclaimed that I was delivering the second best message I've ever given. And it was very important. So if you weren't here, you can hear that for free on the internet, on our website, or you can pick up the CD after the service is over, because I gave a very important talk. And I kept saying, I don't know why it's the second best talk I ever gave, but this morning I figured it out. It's because today is going to be the most important talk I have ever delivered from this platform. That's right. That's right. Aren't you glad you came home early, Dean? Oh, ouch. Big difference. Big difference. 37 degrees to, better than 70, I would say. We are starting to cool off a little at night, though. That'll be, you'll have to appreciate that, because that's about all we got right now. So I am talking today about this topic of saint and sinner. Really good choice on the music, the reading, everything just always ties in so beautifully. And I realized after I wrote the talk, not while I was writing it, that it is actually a continuation of last week's message. So last week, we used this theme from the book Creative Mind, or Dr. Ernest Holmes, and we spoke about true spirituality. And to just give you the short message, the true spirituality, according to Ernest Holmes, is when we can live a perfectly normal life, no better, no worse than anybody else's life, as long as we find joy in our life. And that kind of sums up the whole message, though I'm going to refer back to it a couple times, because I had no idea it was such an introduction to that message that really deserves to be heard, not just here, but in every church around town and all around the world. So this morning, last week, we focused on our role. We talked about forgiveness. We talked about a new way of looking at forgiveness and not blaming people and feeling wounded our entire lives, that you don't have to reconcile a relationship in order to forgive. You just have to quit being so doggone wounded. So we talked about ourselves, what we can do for ourselves. But this week, I am having that same conversation, but we're talking about the other. The other. And I believe that for years I have been trying to find a way to deliver this message, and I don't think I could do it until I gave the second best talk I ever gave last week. So now we're all primed, we're ready to go, and what I want to emphasize is that all of this comes from that book, Creative Mind, that is 100 years old, published 100 years ago by Ernest Holmes. And here is the quote that inspired me to write a talk called Saint and Sinner. When you can see in the saint and the sinner one and the same person, when you can realize that the one who kneels before the altar and the one who lies drunk in the street is the same one. And when you can love that one as much as you do the other, you will see all creation as the perfect work of God. It's a tall order, isn't it? It's a tall order. And, I choose my talk title so far in advance that when I looked at it, I was a little intimidated. Like, can I really say that in here? But I think it's such an important and relevant message because it's a message about interbeing. Have you heard that term before? Interbeing. We talk about, the indwelling presence and the inner being, but we're looking today at interbeing. And Thich Nhat Hanh sort of coined the phrase. I don't know that it was original to him, but he's sort of made it well known. Thich Nhat Hanh said that interbeing is when my view of existence depends on the existence of all beings. You know, it's when we get to that point in our life where we realize this is not a journey you take alone, that we do need each other, including all of the shenanigans that we walk through in our experiences and the conditions of our living. And so we don't necessarily like each other all the time, especially when we're talking about the other, whoever the other is, and there are lots of ways we make people other than ourselves. And I think that's the scary part to deal with. But I also think it's the divisiveness that we're sensing that's going on in sort of this global way. So I want to give you some very, very practical tools today. I think this is a win-win message, and I just can't wait to tell you. So we talk often about honoring all paths. And I figured that was a good place to start, because that's something I am constantly working on in my own life, honoring all paths, honoring all spiritual traditions, and trying to have a more inclusive view of life so that we don't have so many others in our own consciousness all the time. But when we talk about honoring all paths, it's valuable to realize what we're saying is we're seeking to honor a path that is different than our own. And thereby, we see we have created the idea of other. So as we, I used to say, all you have to do is learn to meet people where they are. Just find out what's good about people, bring out the best in them, that's all we have to do. But I don't think that's true anymore. I think that's a really integral part of the whole story. But I think it's the message of Jesus. I think we have to look deeper, and that's why I wanted to talk about you, about this morning. Well, it is, it's about all of us. So Jesus said, treat people the way you want to be treated. Do unto others as you would have others do unto you. And so last week we had that intriguing shift in the way we look at forgiveness, that there's more about forgiveness that is about acceptance. There's an opportunity for us to let go of our woundedness. And as we do that, as we practice that, we begin to realize that, everybody is doing the best they can. But that's not the real gift in it. When you get that, the gift is you begin to realize you too are doing the best you can. Just like me, they would say in Buddhism, just like me, this person is doing the best they can or trying the best they can. So here's the how. Here's where I want to jump right into the how. So we're talking about the drunk in the street or the one that worships at the altar and trying to see that there's no difference. How do we do that? How do you not have an opinion about someone you see laying in the street that's drunk as a skunk? How do you not have a feeling or a reaction or a response to that? But where it becomes more useful is if we personalize it. How can you not have an opinion about the drunk or the addict in your family? How can you not be frustrated with the neighbor in your neighborhood that does not keep their property up to specs, to where it looks as nice as everybody else's, right? And it brings down your idea of living in a nice neighborhood. How do you not have an opinion about that relative that always comes to you to borrow money but never quite pays that money back? So when we're looking at saint and sinner, you know, we can see that we really do have opinions. And I think I tried to say that last week, but it didn't sink in until for me until, you know, this week as I was working on this message. The way we do the how is through spiritual principle. What we teach in this philosophy is that there is a spiritual teaching. We call it the science of mind in the way that Ernest Holmes has outlined it for us. And that if we study the laws of the universe, all the laws of the universe, we will begin to see that they coordinate, they tie in, they correspond to the same laws that apply to all of our relationships and all of the things we go through as human beings. So we often say, God is the macro and we are the microcosm. We're imitating that life. And you could also add to that, that's the created in the image and the likeness of. So when we study principle and we see in nature that there is some kind of a natural order, that nature is always trying, even now in the storms in the Carolinas, that nature is already trying to restore itself to a balance, that there is this innate ability to reveal perfection yet again, or balance, and bringing things back into harmony. Harmony is a divine quality that is ever present on this universe, in this universe. And so as we begin to think that way, it may give us a little breathing room to see that there's always more than one way to look at any situation. Life itself is constantly evolving, is constantly changing, and is constantly advancing, even though sometimes it feels like we're going backwards. So I would say that the opinions we have about all those things, the drunk in the street or the relative that borrows money or whatever it is, creates this big divide, and we are seeing this big divide out picturing the feeling of separation that we may or may not even know we feel. And so there's this underlying, very subtle way that we look at the idea of separation as compared to feeling wholeness or connection to life and to each other, the oneness of life, understanding the connection of oneness in that indwelling presence. There's a way that we stand and a way that New Thought has always taught and presented life, the same thing that I believe Jesus was, the entire message of Jesus was about oneness. The Father and I are one. He comes as the elder brother to show us that as he does these things, so can we. And so we have this sense of separation, especially when things are kind of spicy in the world, because there's so much divisiveness that you feel that disconnect, but you don't identify it. And so what happens is that we have this sort of, I heard it said, called a low level of suffering that we don't even realize we're carrying around. It's kind of like somebody said to me once, I just found out that this ringing in my ears is not normal. I thought everybody had this really loud ringing in their ears. So what we find is we make a normalcy for our life, and then we think that's all there is. And that's why this faith is so, it feeds us in such a positive way, because it's always giving us potential to see that there's something more. So as I thought about all of this, and I was thinking about, well, how do we let go of some of those labels. In fact, some of those labels sort of protect us. And I thought, well, you know what? It's that same principle I've been giving you for many months now. When you notice that life has surprised you, let's just leave it like that. If you notice that life has surprised you, that's a wonderful opportunity to stop, to take a breath, and to choose again. See, when you stop and you take a breath, there's an inhale and there's an exhale. But there's always this slight little pause between the inhale and the exhale, and that's where the neutral zone lies. There's a neutral zone in all change. And in the breath, that's where the neutral zone lies. And in that space that the breath brings is a way for us to now change our idea, change our thought, to imagine other possibilities than whatever it is that we're hanging on to. So when we can let go of those opinions and judgments and labels, the drunk in the street and so on, then what we're knowing is that there's another approach to life that will feed us. Currently, we have this idea that when we see something different, or when we see someone different, that we almost intend to separate. You know, I read somewhere, and I can't find where I read it, darn it. But there's this quote that says, "You're different, go away." Or there's the other, you could stop, breathe, and choose again, and you could say, "You're different. I want to learn about that. Tell me about what it's like to be you." And this, I think, is one of the most important things that we're looking at as we continue to evolve as it looks like things are shifting and changing. Well, they are, and I don't think that's a bad thing. And I think that the rhythm that we're going to is that way of understanding interbeing, or understanding there's a saint and there's a sinner, but all of us are doing the best we can. Which is not to say we can't do better. That's why we show up every day to do better. So as you look at all of this, and we consider that there is something new emerging, then we now have some understanding of what the stages of faith mean. This is why in the classroom I am so dedicated to speaking to the stages of faith. Because every one of us has been a victim at one time or another. And that's the first stage of spiritual growth. You start there. And when you feel like a victim, you're always pointing at what went wrong outside of you. So there's a lot of blaming. We blame others, and we have a lot of shame that we throw on top of that. But then we learn that there's another way of doing that, and we learn to work from Kingdom 2. And Kingdom 2 is where you go see Reverend Cheryl, and she teaches you about treatment, and she shows you her conviction for it. This is where we learn there are things we can do to empower our own lives and that we don't have to be victims. And as we continue on that journey, we have moments then of dipping into the third kingdom where we begin to understand the scriptural meaning of surrender and acceptance. The sacred, not just, I'm not talking about the Bible, but I'm speaking about every religious tradition has some slant in prayer and in sitting quiet. Be still and know. And so it is Kingdom 3 is represented down there as that place of surrender. And then from Kingdom 3, we have these beautiful moments where we pop up and we get it. We feel and experience that oneness with life, and everything is beautiful. Oh, I'm so glad I didn't try and sing it. So in the same way that we have been telling our stories about our woundedness, and the act of forgiveness is the way that we can set down that story so that we're not reopening that wound again and again and again, in that very same way, we can reconsider how we look at others, how we look at differences. It's the very same process. That's why I had to do last week first and this week now. So there is this point where we have to quit making everybody else wrong when we're not happy with what's going on. And I would say that specifically we're talking about the people in our lives or the situations that we encounter and the way that we can use that experience to make new choices. So let me give you an example. There was a teacher who was a brand new teacher, a woman, and she was young and very idealistic and really wanted to make a difference in the world. And so she wanted to teach school somewhere where the children needed the most help. And she decided to apply in different inner city public school systems. And she got a job, and school was about to begin, and she got her list of students. Well, I see we have teachers here. She gets her list of students, and she sees that next to each student's name, there's a number. Mary Smith, 145. John Jones, 152. And she starts perusing all the names and the numbers, and she realizes that these are very smart kids, that these IQs are way above the average student. And so she now reasons that they were worried about her being young and idealistic, so they have given her sort of the best of the students so that she won't get discouraged in her first year. So she walks through that year, she teaches those students, she gives them the best of everything she's got, and by the end of the year, they're doing really well. In fact, they're doing so good that the principal comes to talk to her and he says, "I don't understand what you've done. This is we have never seen this happen before. Your students all got A's and B's, and all the other students are just that average mix. What can you tell us your secret? You brought something that we need to know." And she said, "Well, I saw at the beginning of the year, I saw that they had above average IQs, and so I brought them above average work. I brought in advanced stuff for them to do to keep them curious and hands-on and working, and I had greater expectations for them, and they didn't disappoint me. They lived up to those expectations." And then the principal said, "What are you talking about? We don't know their IQs. We don't tell you their IQs." And she goes, "Well, their numbers right next to their name on the roll sheet." And he said, "Well, those were their locker numbers." So if we let loose of what we think about a room full of students in a public school in an inner city, if we consider that it's not quite what we thought it was, we make it better, look what happens. We have a greater expectation. People will live up to that greater expectation. The way we treat people is the way they will respond. It is the entire message of do unto others as you would have others do unto you. So we're applying this very same logic today to surrendering those opinions we have about the saint or the sinner, or you name it, anything in between. Can we give up the stories that limit what's possible for those people that we have these opinions about, or the other, no matter who the other is? Can you surrender that story that creeps into your mind when you see a homeless person begging for money? Or someone standing in one of those intersections with a sign that's asking for food or money or work? Can you let go of what you think you see to see that there's something more standing right in front of you? Can you surrender that opinion you have about seeing someone in the street drunk or an addict? And even harder, can we surrender our opinion? I'm not saying condone, but can we surrender our opinion of those people in our lives who we've seen drunk or have experienced their addiction and had to move through the difficulty of that lifestyle? And finally, can we surrender our attitudes and our ideas about all the stuff going on in the world, all the divisiveness and the stuff, even the world leaders, Can we lighten up just enough to give ourselves some room to breathe? Because if we don't let go of those opinions, then we hold them in place. Listen to these words from Gary Zukav. By hating evil, or one who is engaged in evil, you contribute to the absence of light. Hatred of evil does not diminish it, it increases it. Martin Luther King, his entire message was a similar message to that. You can use hatred as a weapon, but you cannot use hatred to contain hate. So that's why we always teach you start with yourself. It's an inside job. You start with yourself, and now today we're taking it the next step and say, okay, but I'm going to brave it out there, and I'm going to dare to look at how I judge others. I'm going to dare to look at that way in which I have my way and another way. And so I thought the best example would be to talk about cactus. Yeah, cactus have thorns. And the question is, why does cactus have thorns? I looked it up. She's exactly right. I Googled it this morning, and it turns out that most species of cacti have lost their leaves through this evolution of depending on where things are planted and where they grow. They've lost their leaves, and they only retain the spines, and the spines protect them from the predators or the herbivores, the type of creatures that would eat them. But that's not all that the spines do. They also prevent water loss. Some of them that have a lot of spines actually help to reduce the airflow around the cactus so that it helps to keep the plant a little cooler. Actually, some of those thorny things provide just enough shade to help the cacti thrive. And then if you look at the cactus as like a succulent, you get the understanding that now the photosynthesis in the cactus doesn't happen from the thorns because it doesn't have leaves, but it happens from the body. Am I right on, Annette? Am I close? Okay, good. How about you, Janice, back there?
Absolutely.
Okay, good. So I wouldn't lie to you. Well, Google wouldn't lie to you. I'm just repeating what I studied. So what's important to understand here is that we study nature to learn how to apply spiritual principles in our own life. We study nature. And as we look at why cactus has thorns, we can see that nature grows spines on cacti because a herbivore is out there and might eat them. And we might be afraid something's out to get us too, so we grow thorns, or we grow spiny. Who are the herbivores? I don't mean for the cactus, I mean it symbolically in our own life. Who are the herbivores? Who are the predators? Well, it's anybody that we deem other. Anybody that thinks slightly different than we do or very different than we do. So, right now the big, the loud voice is the conservative or the liberal. But what about the other things like the Catholic and the Protestant, right? Or the Jew and the Christian? What about the good cops and bad cops or bad guys and police officers? There's just this great divide. No matter where you look, there are issues and causes that everybody's up in the air and squawking about. And if we are a cactus, we need those thorns to protect ourselves. Or we can see the role that we play in making choices and not just being taken in by what's going on. By learning these spiritual tools so that we can respond to life and not be a victim. Because the truth is, the stages of growth, it is not that you start here and then you go there and then the next level and the final level. It's that every day we are moving through all four of those stages. Every day, depending on what time of day it is, whether or not you just stubbed your toe or opened your mail, and we get to decide again and again. Are there herbivores out there trying to get us? Are there predators, or is there another way of looking at this? So Holmes tells us, Dr. Holmes was so clear on this. Dr. Holmes said that in order to have, this is, by the way, probably the most important part of that Science of Mind textbook is buried in this part of the message today. And that is on the section where Holmes speaks about attracting friends. Because there's a universal story here. You can use this theory on anything. You could use it on your on trying to understand your finances. You could use it on trying to understand your health issues. So, but it's safe because it's just this simple little beautiful conversation on page 297 and 298, attracting friends. And Holmes says this, in order to have enduring friendships, cultivate an attitude of friendship toward everybody and everything. I think he took that idea from Emerson, because you know what Emerson said? We know he studied Emerson and he loved Emerson. The only way to have a friend is to be one. But you know where Emerson got it? Emerson got it from the Bible, from Proverbs 18:24. A man who has friends must himself be friendly. And yet, at the same time, even before that, the classical philosopher, specifically Aristotle, was preaching and writing and sharing his ideas on friendship that say the same thing. These are classical ideas. And so what I'm suggesting here is this may be the greatest section in the whole Science of Mind textbook. This may be the greatest, most important secret that is revealing itself. It is not really a secret, but as we ponder it, as we get into those pages and we try and apply them personally, we see that Holmes has given us a formula. He has given us a specific formula. He says on page 297, here's how you have friends. Begin to imagine ideal relationships. Now, this is not saying you pick a person that you wished would be your friend. This is that you pick the highest idea of a wonderful friend. You create your own idea of that. You begin to imagine the ideal relationships that you would benefit from. Number two, you sense and feel the presence of those friends. And then he goes on to say, and then as you're sensing and feeling it, enjoy it in your mind. Enjoy it as a reality, not as an illusion. Enjoy it as an experience, not as some dream, that it is already done. And this is the crux of everything we teach. See it in your mind. Sense it. Feel it. Enjoy it as a reality and experience it in your mind first. Holmes states here that the entire point of our life on this planet is to learn to love. To learn to love. And that's why I think friendship is such a great place to take in his wisdom. In fact, Holmes also says, until we learn to love, this is on the next page, 298, until we learn to love, we are not sending out love vibrations, and not until we can send out love vibrations can we receive love in return. This is a universal lesson. And in the Science of Mind, in New Thought, we teach it as a core concept. Big capital letters, I hear this, and you've heard me say this before. These are the words of Holmes. Refuse to see the negative side of anyone. Refuse to let yourself be misunderstood. Quit defending yourself. Quit thinking people haven't understood exactly. Quit thinking you didn't quite fit in. We never quite fit in because we're individuals. And so as we stop and we breathe and we rest in that neutral zone for a while, we can begin to see that nobody is really out to disagree with us. Everybody is just looking to have people agree so that there is no other. And that when we don't feel agreement, we create an other. When we feel like we have to explain ourselves because we've been misunderstood, we're defending ourselves. And your safety only lies when you let down all that defense. Stop. Breathe. Choose again. Do not grow thorns. You have a choice. And always remember that love is the grandest healing and drawing force on the earth. It is our very reason for being. So to sum it up, I would say that for me, it's becoming clearer and clearer that we, everyone, in your own way, we are all on an individual journey. And it is a journey from the story of separation into a new story of oneness. And I believe that we can see how much progress that mankind has accomplished in this journey by looking at the way people are less and less enamored with traditional religion. The way in which people are longing to have spiritual connection, but they're not so sure about religion anymore. And I don't want to see people losing faith. I don't want people to give up their favorite way of worship. I don't want everybody to learn to pray like we do, but I sure would like it if everybody would learn to approach prayer not from the position of being not worthy and that you have to beg for any goodness you want, but that you are born absolutely worthy. You are created in the image and the likeness of. And the only lesson we are here to learn is about love. It is about that story of oneness. It is about interdependency and is ultimately about interbeing. I'm thankful that you are here today, so that I don't have to talk so serious next week. And but now I want to anchor this in the words of prayer. And as we move into prayer, go ahead, practitioners and ministers, you may stand. As we pray, I want you to reflect back on everything that has been discussed this morning and find that gem of truth that you need right here in your life right now. So take a breath. And inhale. And an exhale. That precious pause where we turn within. We begin to sense that movement of life in our very bodies. The presence of God. The